After the last board meeting last Wednesday, and went over with Rosalva Flores from Brown Armstrong the audit, and she's with us today to present that and Ms. Henderson, and also the CAFR. So.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Thank you for the introduction. As was just announced, I did have a meeting over the phone with your audit committee, and we went over, gave your audit committee a good summary of the results of your December 31, 2016 financial statements. We also went into detail on some of the recommendations that I have for you this year, and because went into great detail on those, I'm not going to cover them in great detail unless, you know, you want to ask any questions. But I am going to go over all of the audit opinions today. But what I also want to do is kind of give you a really quick overview of how we conduct our audit, and also give you a quick overview of why the audit is so important. So as you know, your organization has a CAFR that is published every year. And every time that the CAFR is provided to the public, there are a lot of users out there that rely on this information. And what management asserts with this published CAFR is that the financial statements are fairly stated in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, and that they are not materially misstated. So with that in mind, you know, it's very important for us to come out every year and perform an independent audit of your financial statements, and kind of give the users of the financial statement that little stamp of approval that the financial statements were prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, and all GASB standards were followed, and that no material misstatements were noted. So with that, really quick, just to go over the audit process, we do commence with establishing a timeline with your staff, and that's a really important part of our audit because we don't want to have any miscommunications during our audit. We want to be sure to establish a timeline that we understand what the expectations are regarding our deliverable of the reports, and we've done that every year, and it's always been a really great process because we'll develop a timeline. We'll meet with management to make sure those dates are going to work. And then as the audit is progressing, if there's any needed changes, we go ahead and tweak those dates. But ultimately, we're able to be here and present our audit opinions. So just like in the past, that process has worked very well. And this year was no exception. So as far as I know, there weren't any deadlines missed. So before we come out to perform your audit, we develop our audit plan, and that involves determining a risk analysis of all your account balances and kind of focus on what areas we're going to heavily look at based on risk assessment and determining what accounts have a higher susceptibility of risk. And so once that plan is developed, we come out and perform testing of your internal controls. These are your checks and balances, and this always ensures that all your transactions are being recorded and reported correctly. So when we're coming out and looking at all your accounting controls, looking at your policies, updating our permanent file, we're also spending a lot of time talking to your staff while they're performing their day-to-day routines to make sure that we understand what these procedures are and whether they're being followed, and that there are no issues that we need to be concerned. So once that is completed and we can complete our understanding of those areas, we come out and reassess our audit plan. If we need to make any significant changes to incorporate any other risk areas that we might have noted through those procedures, then we make an adjustment to our audit plan. I do want to note that at the onset of the audit, before we even start our procedures, we do also have a meeting with your audit committee to discuss our scope And they have an opportunity to hear, you know, what our proposed plan is. And they also have an opportunity to, if there's any issues or any areas that they want us to look at in particular, they have an opportunity to comment on our plan, and we'll incorporate that as well into our audit plan. So I know this year we had the same process. There were a couple of things that we talked about, and those were also incorporated into our audit this year. So before we actually come out to perform our field work testing, we're also sending confirmation to third parties. This is a very important part of our audit process, because information that comes from these outside organizations is considered better audit evidence, instead of as opposed to getting information from within the organization. So as we're doing that process and during our planning, we're sending out confirmations to confirm information regarding your investments. We're sending letters to all your investment managers. We're sending letters to your custodian. But we also do letters to your participants, both active and retired. And we typically do samples of 40 and 60 for each. And we're sending out that information to be able to corroborate that what is being included in your system is accurate regarding dates of entry or dates of retirement for the retirees. And then when we get these confirmations back, if there are any differences noted, we'll go ahead and come out and follow up on those as we're performing our procedures. And then we also send confirmations to your actuary. We do this on an annual basis as well, to make sure that we are corroborating that that information that is being utilized by your actuary to come up with the estimate of the pension liability, that they have a complete and accurate data of that is being used to develop these estimates. So we typically also send out a list of participants for them to confirm, to make sure that they agree on the data that is being utilized. And then they also usually send us a small sample of about 5 or 10, telling us the data that they have on their system, and then we utilize that information to compare that to what you have in your system. And then also we do send confirmations to your legal attorneys, just to make sure that we have all the information we need for any possible disclosure or any possible accrual of any liabilities that would affect your plan. So before your books are closed, we come out and perform our first portion of the audit, which is called interim testing. And this is when we're testing all your systems. Again, we're looking at the participant data in particular. We're getting an understanding of your internal controls. And then we're also updating our permanent files to make sure that we have all the information we need regarding any relevant contracts that were entered by the system during the year, and that would be relevant to our audit. And then once your interim testing is completed and we go back to our office again, depending on what the results were, we'll update our audit plan accordingly. And then once your books have actually been closed, we come back to the final portion of the audit, and this is when we're substantiating all your account balances that are being reported in your CAFR. And then once we complete our final field work and we wrap up back at the office, we are assisting with the review of the CAFR before it's actually published. Any questions on the audit process? Okay. So then I'll go ahead and before I talk about audit opinions, I just want to talk a little bit about the significant audit areas, just to kind of give you an idea of what areas we focus on and why. As I stated earlier, when we perform our audit, we're doing a risk-based approach. And as you know, we come out a few times a year, but we can't look at every single transaction. So our audit is based on a risk-based approach. And so when we develop our plan, we identify areas, again, that we consider have a higher risk of error, irregularities, or fraud. And so those are the areas that we primarily focus on. Not to say that these are the only things that we look at, but they are the areas that we spent the majority of our attention to. So these items are investment and related earnings. And you know that one, obviously, there's a significant dollar amount of transactions in those accounts. So we want to make sure that we spend a lot of time in that area. And like I said, we primarily get information from these third parties to ensure that we have these ending balances confirmed. And then participant data and actuarial information, that's always very important because participant data pretty much is what drives everything. And again, actuarial information, that's what drives the pension liability. And then as far as employee and employer contributions and benefit payments, you know, we're talking about a lot of transactions flowing through your system on a daily basis. And then the last two items are pretty significant gas fees that have been added recently that we spend a lot of time on. You're familiar with 67 and 68 and all the additional procedures that we've been having to do in that area. And then GASB 72 this year was a new standard that required additional disclosures regarding your investments. And while it's a new standard for the government world, it's actually not a new standard. That one mirrors FASB Topic 820 on fair value measurements. And what that did, again, is just added additional disclosures to your financial statements. And that note disclosure is on note 4. And it begins on page 42. So you can kind of see that now investments are being placed in different levels. And again, this is very similar to what, you know, private sector already had. So that's what GASB 82 is. And then it explains kind of, if you look at the next page, how those were determined.
This new statement, thank you, Ms. Helva. This new statement is new, as you mentioned, it's new for this year and involved a comprehensive review with our custodian bank, our outside investment companies, the obtaining of audited financial information, their methodology and how they value themselves and what their process is. It was an extensive review with our investment team, Tim and Jeff and Chi-Chi. And so the concept is here is not really changing the financial statements, it's just categorizing the investments in certain levels. So it's not like 67 or 68 where it's actually requiring certain entries to be done. It's just a process that discloses to the reader or the CAFR how these fair values and where they're derived. And the concept being that level one is the most easiest obtainable source. You know, they're very publicly traded investments. Level two is comparable, generally speaking. Level three is, well, they're more thinly traded and it requires more management discussion, subject matter experts such as Tim. And and as you can see, we have no level threes. And the fourth category is what we call net asset value. Those are all our alternative investments. And they're valued in a methodology that's validated by looking at their audited financial statements. It's net asset value, and so they drop in the category. And the note goes on to describe which ones they are, and they are the public market commingled funds, the private credit, the private equity funds, and it gives a synopsis on what they do.
Thank you, Henry. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to have Henry go over this because while it looks like a fairly easy note disclosure, there was a lot of work done before we even came out to audit, you know, gathering a lot of information. So it was a lot of work. And I commend Henry and everyone on Gail on the financial side, Tim as well, for assisting with providing this information. We also did a lot of testing on our end. For instance, on the level one, we selected a sample to make sure that those items should be in that bucket because, you know, obviously those are the ones that have the less risk because they are quoted market prices. But we wanted to make sure that they were being placed in the correct bucket.
The other philosophy, just if I add, is the line items. The line items, we also had discretion and we built our line items to closely parallel how we're categorizing our investment philosophy, our investment policy. So there is an easier read when we jump from document to document. So there won't be so much of like, where's this coming from? And this is this data different from another record we saw? So that's part of the whole transparency philosophy. It's like, where have I seen this before? And it ties closely and it tries to mirror with a lot of the detail you get from the investment department.
Henry Harvey has a question.
Yes, sir.
Thanks. Rosalba, in the private equity and private credit net asset values, do you independently audit the values reported to us by the managers?
Good question. As I said, you know, we do have to rely a lot on what private equity's independent auditors have. So we do obtain their audited financial statements. And a lot of the alternative investments don't have the SOC reports or the reports on internal controls. But we also look at those when they do have them available. But what we have to do in addition to that is not only look at the policies that your organization has in regards to how they're categorizing, but we're also looking at the financial statements, particularly looking at their investment notes to see how they are being valued. Does that answer your question?
I'm trying to understand if do you go into the portfolio holdings and independently audit the values that are being reported to us of the whatever the portfolio holdings may be.
Well, and when you say if we audit the portfolio, I mean, we will do our recalculations by getting these reports from third parties and recalculating back to your records to make sure that they agree. A lot of these alternative investments do provide us final value, so we are able to satisfy ourselves with, again, that they have audited financial statements from independent auditors.
So you're accepting their auditor's report. You're not testing those audits.
No.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Can I expand on that?
Sure.
Just the issue, as at least I've sort of come to recognize it, is an audited report that is very clear in terms of cost, but it's the fair market value determination. Some will move to market. Some will stay at cost. Do you look at those distinctions? Do you attempt to get fair market value at each one of these?
We actually do. When we send out our confirmations, again, we are obtaining the cost information and the fair value from these investment managers, so we are looking at both.
Okay. Do you see them where they're the same, and do you accept that just as a given? Are there any where you would challenge fair market value? Do any go below cost? I'm just thinking of some of the kinds of issues you're going to run into.
I don't think we've ran into that yet because, like I said, we do perform our reconciliations. And when there are questions, we do email the investment manager right away if we see a difference from pricing or, methodology that they've used from prior year, we are reaching out to these investment managers directly and asking questions. But we've never had an issue where we could say, oh, we don't agree with the fair market value, because again, a lot of our procedures are relying on these financial statements that we review on an annual basis and make sure that they are being audited by recognized firms, and there are no issues such as a going concern or, an opinion that is not clean.
I'm assuming you don't go back, and I probably unreasonably even think about it, you don't go back historically, look at what fair market value was assumed to be.
Oh, no, we do start from last year, and provided that they give us the activity during the year, we do reconcile that way.
Where I'm coming on this is somebody has a continuing pattern of mm-hmm. assuming high during the holding period, mm-hmm. and the actual sale produces a result much lower than the fair market value assumption was mm-hmm. in prior years. How you do that in a practical way mm-hmm. would be a challenge, but I'm assuming you don't try and do that.
Well, we do perform, like I said, a variance analysis, so that's a really good question. And again, we are looking at the beginning balances, and then reconciling back to the ending by looking at that activity. So if we saw like big swings and something that just wasn't a contribution or a distribution, then we would be questioning that.
And that's basically for the year then ending?
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the process on our side, our investment reconciliations, is to tie to an investment balance that's equal to, remember, the old lower cost or market, and that is a big part of Reliance. They produce their audited financial statements, and if they're audited financial statements, they go through the same review as our auditors are doing. They go to the client and they say, how is your basis? What is your fair market calculations? And that's where the Reliance comes in. So the numbers that we disclose here, do we test assurance that they match what the partner is saying? And that's part of the Reliance feature that happens. As long as we trust the Reliance and the information flow from the investment managers, and they're producing quality information, you know, the transparency and the information flow is solid.
Well, lower cost or market would be very conservative in good years, but in 2008, 2009, at least 2008, mm-hmm. That might be not conservative.
Well, it would address the issue of, well, you paid for this, but your market is this. You need to report it at the lower. You need to take the loss, the unrealized loss that your asset is currently riding in.
I'm just suggesting that to the extent possible, they would not want to identify that. You know, the natural inclination would be...
That's not our goal, right?
Right. Anyway.
Right. But in our effort, when the confirmations get sent out to the... typically what happens is you'll have an investment, says this is the full value of the fund. Cicera share is this, because this equals to your partnership share. And there's a calculation that the team goes through, and they verify that this is the number that you're using on our financial statements. And they go backwards, and they go to the investment company. Does this agree on their side? Do you have information to substantiate those numbers? So if there's missing, some of the problems that we might touch upon is that an investment firm is taking some time and closing their books. They're dealing with year-end issues. We may have to do a roll forward from the third quarter of their year mm-hmm. all the way to the fourth quarter. And there's a small handful of companies that they struggle, well, not struggle, but their timing of their audit is not finished at the same time we're trying to complete our books. So they may not be able to produce audited financials. But the next alternative plan is we go back to their third quarter and roll forward a fourth quarter, and that's the figure that we use here. And it falls under the use of best estimates.
And we do the same thing. We do a roll forward because there's a lot of the alternative investments that, you know, at the time that we come out and even after we wrap up the audit, they won't have final values for us.
I think Mr. Price has a comment.
Just one clarifying point. Everything is classified under net asset value. We are sending out basically request to how do you calculate fair market value for this vehicle, and we are incorporating, if we agree with their methodology, that they are calculating according to a methodology that makes sense to us. It's their fair market value calculation that goes into a net asset value. So nothing is coming in here at net asset value regardless of methodology. We record at net asset value when the net asset value is calculated according to a logical fair market value.
Can you think of any where we didn't agree?
No.
No.
I mean, fair market value methodology is standard now on these private investment vehicles, and it has been for a number of years.
I think that's true. This formula here, this we call it GASB because it's a governmental formula, but it's been around for many years in the private industry world. And so our efforts to solicit this information was... jumping on procedures that have already been in existence before. I think Rosalvo mentioned the rule.
Topic 820.
Topic 820. And so when I mentioned GASB 72, companies were like, what? What? You know, what are you talking about? They got their attorneys involved and all this, and it's like, no, no, no,
you have
to tell
them Topic 820.
Exactly. As soon as I mentioned the magic, you know, terms, oh, okay, here you go. So the information, you know, came in, you know, a lot easier. So it's where the whole governmental accounting and private industry accounting merge together. So we're just merely trying to follow existing audit rules that have been in existence.
I'm greatly encouraged, though, by the information Tim added here, though, that there is due diligence being undertaken to ascertain how they're establishing that value. And you're looking behind the number. That wasn't clear earlier. So that's important for us to know. Because otherwise, this whole system seems to me is premised on trust. Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, I wanted to add one more thing, and thank you, Tim, for mentioning that. But, you know, another thing that we have to be comfortable too is when we come out is that, you know, there is good monitoring of these investment managers. So, you know, Tim has a great checklist, and, you know, when we're coming out, we're performing our interviews because, you know, we want to make sure that after the onset of hiring these managers that there is a continued monitoring. So we do place reliance knowing that there is a process, there are checklists and other alternative procedures that affirm to us that there is a good process and review ongoing.
Right, but the history of this, we talked about this, I think, in prior years since I've been coming to these meetings, is that the lessons from the 08 meltdown included the complicity of rating agencies mm-hmm. in providing false security, mm-hmm. not to misuse that term, false security in the veracity of an investment, because in many instances it was documented, and this is well known, you can read Too Big to Fail, Big Short, any one of these books, that those firms were actually calling Goldman Sachs and other traders to say, well, what was your last trade? What's the value of this derivative?
Right.
Because nobody really knew. That's how the value got established, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a real trust. That's why I said earlier, mm-hmm. a lot of what you're saying, I think, is that you're relying on the financials of other mm-hmm. providers mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. trusting, as you must, mm-hmm. that they're accurate.
Yes.
And they were prepared in accordance with applicable requirements, right? Mm-hmm.
There is some trust, yes. And there's some verify. Mm-hmm. You know, you say the number's this, and we say we trust that, but we mm-hmm. also verify. I mentioned the methodologies, not just the numbers on the balance sheet, but there's footnote disclosure. What is your methodology? How do you go through? And we'll perform some recalculation.
I feel a lot more comfortable with this discussion today about
that. There's many hours behind this, and to wrap it up and summarize it here, it doesn't give it fair justice, but there was a lot of back and forth and put together, but it's part of the making sure that the plan assets are administered, the fiduciary responsibility, and so.
That's well, our whole plan is we've gone to an FFP function in how we're going to manage mm-hmm. our assets or mm-hmm. invest our assets, I should say. Mm-hmm. Puts a premium on this issue, right, to get it right. Because we're not dealing in highly marketable assets, right? We're looking at alternative valuation methodology, so that's critical, it seems to me.
The long end of the barbell.
The long end of the barbell.
And I want to piggyback on something Rosalva mentioned. You know, GASB 72, you look at it, it's a couple pages in here, looks good,
harmless,
there's
right?
Very harmless. There's been a lot of work. I mean, we've had over a number of months, we've had team meetings on this and making sure, you know, we're doing what we need to be doing. And even after we received some of the custodial data, we pushed back on them, like, well, what about this? And why did you show this? And, you know, there's been a lot of dialogue relating to GASB 72. And so I want to commend our staff on that because it is a lot of work that's gone into this.
And that's encouraging.
And I think that now comforting. We have a repeatable process for in the future, you know, on an annual basis for this reporting. Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of CSRs who are seeking us out, asking for what was your process? Give me some tips. What went well? What didn't go well? You know, there's a network of CSRs that have to run the same role, and mm-hmm. so you all get together. And how did you do it? What kind of issues did you encounter? And we have, you know, feedback to provide. And part of it starting early. Our issues were very different. You know, we compared to our folks, our neighbor Alameda. They have all their investments held at State Street, 100% custodian, which is very different from our setup.
Right.
We have a lot of alternative investments, and we had to deal directly with the companies. Part of me prefers it that way because you have more of a one-on-one relationship, and it also follows the policy and the investment approach that we're seeking. And but we had stories to tell. As Gail pointed out, the custodian will send you a report, and they'll say, oh, these are all level ones, these are all level twos, and you analyze it. Well, how did you come up with that determination? What was your process? And that's where you go behind the...
Yeah, that's the key. That's important.
There you go. There you go. And that's what it is. You know, yes, we can accept them, but before we do, there is a discussion. You know, if they would have come back and said, these are all level threes, we're like, wait a minute, how you know, is that what we're buying? You know?
No, excellent. That's great.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Henry. So unless there's any other questions, I'm going to go ahead and jump to the audit opinions. So in your CAFR, we have the independent auditor's report on the financial statements. And again, this is the opinion that we have reviewed information, have obtained substantial audit evidence, and we are comfortable with the numbers and can say that the financial statements are being following all GASB pronouncements as required, and that there are no material misstatements. So I am happy to report that we are issuing an unmodified opinion on your financial statements. The other thing that I just wanted to add is on the second page, you're gonna see something a little different. It's an emphasis of a matter. You always wanna look at that paragraph because sometimes an emphasis of a matter can be a bad thing. But in this case, it's not. So I just wanted to make sure I pointed it out. Because we thought implementing 72 was kind of a big deal, you know, it added additional disclosures as we talked about. And so we just emphasized that we implemented 72 in the current year, but it does not affect our audit opinion at all. Any questions on that report? Okay. And then also in your packets, you're going to see a report to the board and the audit committee. That's a report that includes three different reports, so I'll go through each one of them. The first one is what we call the required communication to you. And this one, as you know, we do meet with the audit committee to talk about the scope of the audit. But, you know, as we're conducting the audit, we don't really never have an opportunity to communicate with you. Instead, mainly we're talking to management on a day-to-day basis when we're out here. So as a way to solidify to you and give you information that our audit was performed in accordance with standards and that we didn't have any issues, we are required by professional standards to issue this letter. And some of the things that would be required that I report to you was, for instance, if we have any disagreements with management, if we came up with an adjustment that was considered significant, or even if we found a small adjustment that it was decided that it shouldn't be posted to the books because it was considered immaterial. The other thing is if we implemented a new standard. So I only have one item to report. Well, I am happy to let you know that we didn't have any disagreements with management. I think we work very well together as in the past. And we did implement, as we stated, a GASB 72. That was the one that was a little bit more significant. But as Henry stated, it didn't change anything on your financial statements. It was pretty much just a presentation GASB. And then we also implemented a couple other ones, GASB 73 and 76. But those were just, you know, required GASBs, but they didn't have an impact on your financial statements. And then I also just wanted to let you know that we didn't propose any audit adjustments. And I do want to emphasize that, you know, that is a big deal because if during the audit we were to find an audit adjustment that was considered significant, that could actually trigger a material weakness in your internal control report. So I'm happy to report that we didn't have any audit adjustments that we propose or any immaterial ones that were not posted to your books.
Excellent. So Henry can smile.
Yes. There you go.
And I want to, again, commend Henry and Gail and the rest of the team because, again, I mean, it's not uncommon that, you know, we have proposed audit adjustments and sometimes they are considered significant. And, again, that can trigger a material weakness. Any questions on that report? Okay. So the next one, I talked a little bit about internal controls earlier. Again, you know, we come out and look at, you know, what policies and procedures you have, whether you have adequate segregation of duties, you know, whether everything is being done as it should so that there are no issues. And so we also come out and test compliance with your laws and regulations to make sure that, you know, all laws and regulations are being followed. And so I'm happy to report that we didn't find any instances in which your organization was not following laws and regulations. And we don't have any material weakness or significant deficiencies to report. So having said that, sometimes when we come out, we have observations that we consider our best practices. And again, they don't mean that there's anything wrong with your controls. Sometimes it could just be items that we think might be something, an area that you should consider maybe that would be a best practice. You know, we always have recommendations that are of benefit to you that are not cost prohibited or that would be more of a cost than a benefit. So there's a few of them, and like I said, I cover these in detail with your audit committee. We went one by one. So I won't go one by one, but you know I'm open to any questions if you want to go over any of those, if you have any questions regarding any.
I don't have any questions. Just have a comment. Condition number three, the life status letter.
Yeah.
I really want to. That was a big issue for us that in one instance and. It was a real learning lesson for us, and your recommendation is appropriate, and I understand we're looking at doing that. And I think that was a good idea. So that part of it was interesting to me. Thank you.
On that same item, you don't have to go through the whole letter, but mm-hmm. what does an alive and well letter basically say? I mean, is it a check mark at the bottom? Is it alternative?
Alive?
Not what you want to find.
Can you write your name?
I am alive, yes, no, yes, maybe. No.
Well, are there any steps that we ask for certification?
Yes, no.
Or we ask for, you know.
What do we do?
Anything. Is it a caretaker that checks the box?
Is it a certified letter? All like
certified?
Yeah. What is it?
To what extent are we satisfied that this is coming back from the person without having had a mirror put under their nose?
So my stepdad's 82, and he gets a pension from work years ago. Mm-hmm. Every year he has to verify that he's alive. He has to go to a notary and
that's
show the ID and get that.
That's the
really?
Question. Okay.
Does
ours require a notary as well?
Not currently,
but that is the subject as to what do you do after the alive and well letter? What do you ask the retirement to do? Get a notary, drive down here. You mentioned the situation of the caretaker. Mm-hmm. What did they sign off? That does that really mean the person
right.
is alive? So
I'd feel more comfortable if we had at least that additional step, so that it's not simply the the surviving son, the neighbor, the whoever it is that checks the box.
And we've experienced that very thing, right?
I'm speaking from some experience.
Your audit committee basically agrees with that, and I think that that's what the guidance that we were giving Gail and staff.
Well,
and
excuse
Henry.
Me for bringing it up.
No.
I
realized the committee was so on top of this.
I was giving you confidence in your committee.
All right, okay.
Did you guys discuss like a dated selfie? Was that?
Something? So they can hold up today's newspaper.
Right.
That's
right.
Then they may not be so well, but at least they're alive. Right?
It's a hostage photo.
Yeah. Well, I think we talked about this at a prior meeting unrelated to the audit findings, but there was a 60 Minutes piece, I think, that looked at
Social Security.
And the 110-year-olds and 12-year-olds who were still receiving Social Security have been dead for 30 years, right?
You're right. And so that another reason? Is Social Security system, is that the threshold? Do we follow exactly what they do for
us. Apparently we shouldn't.
No, it's right.
We don't.
So yeah. There you go.
No, that's yeah.
So it's but they're going to start that part. Thank you for the audit committee mention, because we did talk at great length, and so and I believe that's what we're going to do. We're going to solicit the letter to get notarized. So that'll be the follow-up. Now, a notary, we offer free notary help here, too, so they can come on by.
Yeah, they could just come into the office.
There you go.
Well, there are also traveling notaries, now very common,
that
will go to your home.
Yeah.
So you don't have to go find somebody in some other location at this point.
That's right. But we just want the assurance, whatever we can, that added prevention in addition to the services that we have to eliminate this, so it's agreed upon.
Yes, so an Uber driver with a notary.
That's right.
You can now tell.
Perfect.
A great idea. You think 90 is a good age? It should be earlier.
That's another discussion. That's a up to this, you know, subject. Yes, a threshold of earlier is reasonable.
But just based on the actuarial table.
Yeah, the actuarial lawyer. Right? Yeah, what he says is a
right. This is another one where we can, like, meet with our agencies, fellow agencies. What process do you employ? What age do you choose? What issues have you encountered? This is probably a better discussion for Tim Hoppier, benefits
yes.
manager, because he's got a lot of good feedback on it. But it makes its way to the recommendations letter, because this is one of the good approaches that we do, and we felt that this was important to bring in front of our board to say we agree.
And I'm assuming that the Life Systems 360 techniques include that they search death registries and official public records.
Absolutely.
And all yes.
yeah.
and so
absolutely.
Forth.
Yes. Absolutely. It's important to note that their service, we switch from a weekly report mm-hmm. to an online daily update. And Tim's team really jumps on it. It's an everyday review. We send off letters or we get advice of deaths or, you know, folks that we should, you know, investigate. So it improved, so the service improved, and sort of the notification to us, the use of more technology.
Excellent info, thank you.
Any other questions on any of the recommendations? Okay. All right, so that wraps up my presentation, and unless there's any other questions, I just, again, wanted to thank Gail, Henry, and the rest of the staff for all their help during our audit. You know, we come out in 1 week, year in, interim, and ask for a lot of information, so being able to be here and present to you the financial statements and being able to file this, it still is going to go to the GFOA. And, you know, it's a lot of work to put this together. And from past years, we always look at the GFOA comments, even after you receive the award, to see what kind of comments they are. And it's always just a few comments. So it takes a lot of work to put it together. Not only that, to just get a few comments from the GFOA means that it's a really good product. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Thank you, Rosalva. I wanted to follow up on that, because the next step with your concurrence and acceptance of the CAFR is to file an application with the GFOA. And what happens there is it gets passed out to another committee of members in the industry, people that have subject matter expertise, finance directors, chief financial officers who are members of GFOA, and part of their role is to provide their feedback and say, does the report look well? Does it read well? Is it, you know, is it easy to understand? And kind of that layman approach of, if this is in the hands of the average reader on the street, does it present the information well? And also, does it prescribe to industry standards? So I know the award in itself, you know, it sounds okay, well, you know, you should get it, but there is a process to go through. And those comments are very important for us, because we get feedback and say, you know, your schedule is a little awkward here, you need to add this, or you need to change that. Or they might say, you're missing a piece here. And that's the part that I really enjoy, because it gets compared to other CAFRs out there in the industry. You don't know who's looking at this. It could be somebody from Virginia somewhere on the East Coast or something that actually gives feedback, and they put their comments together on it. So we have until the end of the month to file it. And there's another bit of report that we do. It's called the PAFR, and that's the popular annual financial report. And it's important to note that I think we've been receiving the award since the year 2000. So we're on a roll. We're going on our 16th year. And the PAFR just started in later than that. We're going for
10
fifth.
Or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So these are important. These are
so
important.
Are you seeking direction from us to tell you to go and do this?
Not at all. Just because we're going to do it, but I'm advising you what it is behind the scenes. You know, it's not just an award you can buy on the street. You know, it's like you actually got to earn it.
Good.
Okay. Thank you.
Henry, Rosella, yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, before you leave, Henry, again, every time I read this thing, I thoroughly enjoy it. I like looking at all the numbers and figuring out, you know, where I am in the thing and where everybody else is and what goes on. And again, actually yesterday I spent about 4 hours going through it, and this time I read the whole thing and enjoyed it. Last time you asked me, I hadn't finished all, so I felt bad, but I did read it all, and again, I enjoyed it. It's a good piece of literature, and whenever I go to retiree groups or retiree meetings, I always suggest that they, if they want to know what we do, they read the CAPRA. And they get in the mail, they get the PAFR.
Yeah. There you go.
They get the PAFR.
It's a condensed version. It's, you know, just code of it, right?
I know. So, but anyway, this is very good, and especially good for retirees to read. So thank you for doing it.
Very good. And very good.
Please don't ever give it up.
Just no. Call me.
And I'd like to thank our accounting department as well as our communications coordinator. They keep doing a great job with it.
So we came up with a design.
So design was a...
I mean, I recognize it. It's kind of like a website, right?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious.
Yeah, we went through a few iterations with that one. But
that's cool.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.